to the next speaker. Dan Boothley is going to talk about stellar progenitors and central engines.
Thanks. I'll give you five minutes warning.
Okay.
I do want to talk about the theory of gamma ray bursts, and I specifically want to address a topic that I think is of great interest to all of us, and that is, what is a gamma ray burst? You know, what makes it? That for me has always been the key issue, and it always involves the guy at the middle. What is the thing at the middle? What is the engine? If you need a jet, what's the jet engine? And much more than in the previous two decades, in the last few years, we've had a lot more guidance from our observer friends, and so we've become a little more constrained. In fact, it's gotten almost too constrained. 2 years ago, you could go to a meeting, and the goal was 10 to the 51 ergs, and we thought that we could open the champagne if we ever got there. And then they raised it to 10 to the 52, and we said, okay. And then 10 to the 53 last year, and it was starting to get kind of tough, and now it's 10 to the 54. And I think our observer friends must be saying, how high can you go? As they keep... Well, that was already in there. and of course, our friend Ellie Waxman and others tell us, by the way, you can't turn energy into gamma rays with 100% efficiency. And most of us like to leave out that factor, but it might be on the order of 20% for the conversion in, say, internal shocks into gamma rays. And so in the most energetic events, we really are facing enormous energy constraints, but as I'll try to demonstrate, it might still be within our grasp. But if you raise it about another factor of 10, it's going to get very tough, and then the field might get rather chaotic. You may not want to do that. One of the nice things about raising the energy is that you can raise the mass contamination to go with it, and that helps a bit, but we still need gamma greater than on the order of 100. We need an event rate that satisfies BATSE. That is about 3 events per day. BATSE sees about a third of them. Some of the gamma ray bursts need to happen in star-forming regions and near galaxies. And of course, as has been stated many times, these bursts that Befosax sees are selected. Befosax doesn't trigger on anything shorter than 5 seconds, and so we have no information about bursts that last 1 second or so. And there are at least 2 classes, perhaps 3, of so-called classical gamma ray bursts. There are the long, hard ones with an average duration in our frame of 20 seconds. Understand, if the redshift is 1 or 2, then in the frame of the engine, it's more like 10 seconds or 7 seconds. And another group at about 0.3 seconds. And there really are a lot of bursts in each category. This is the hardness ratio, the same plot though, the duration and the hardness ratio, and shows that you clearly do have a group that is both short and relatively hard with an average around 0.3 seconds, and there are a lot of them. There are not as many of these as of those, but a third seems a reasonable number. And then there are the long bursts, and this is a slide that Richard Lingenfelter showed from Marco Tavani. The blue events are the ones that we have redshifts from following up Befosax locations, and the red dot is supernova 98BW, April 25. And so it seems clear to me, as a theorist anyway, that this separates into at least 2 groups, and it may well be that more than one thing is going on in the sky. And I think that a good theory ought to explain why the duration of one set is 0.3 seconds and why the duration of another set is 20 seconds. And I'd be a little leery of making the merging neutron stars and black holes all last longer than a second, because then how are you going to make the short bursts? How can you make a burst that is shorter than the duration of the engine? I don't know how to do that. So, as has also been alluded to, but just getting back into the groove here, most of the models that are favored these days involve a common endpoint, but several ways of getting there. The common endpoint is a black hole of a few solar masses, a stellar mass black hole, not a supermassive black hole, that accretes at a very fast rate, like 0.1 to up to 10 solar masses per second. And you can make that by neutron star mergers, by black hole plus neutron star, by the failure of the prompt explosion mechanism, the neutrino-powered bubble in a massive stellar core, and the star collapses in and makes a black hole and then falls into its own hole. Or you can have the merger of a black hole and a white dwarf, or the merger of a black hole with the helium core of a companion star. There are several ways of getting here, and some are more likely than others. I want to concentrate today on especially three of these. These two have already been discussed extensively. I want to say a few words about those and spend most of my time on the collapsar model. Once you've made your black hole, as has also been alluded to, there's several ways to get the energy out. You can invoke the rotational energy of the black hole and say the magic words, and many people do that, Blanford Zajnek, and invoke a certain amount of energy, which might be up to a few times 10 to the 53 ergs. You can also get on the order of the same amount of mass by accreting a solar mass or more into a black hole in the collapsar model, about an order of magnitude less energy in the merging neutron star and neutron star black hole case. But on the order of 10 to the 53 ergs is the maximum from these magnetohydrodynamic techniques, and that large number is what many people find appealing. And especially if you can beam that, then you can get up to the enormous energies that we're observing and maybe another factor of 10 beyond that. Another way, though, of doing the energy transport problem, of putting energy along the rotational axis of the black hole and hopefully powering the jet, is with neutrino annihilation. Now, this is a different sort of solution in which the disk is very hot. It emits neutrinos, and the neutrinos do annihilate near the surface of the disk as well, Bodin, and that is a concern. The viscosity of the disk, in fact, deposits more energy than the neutrino annihilation does, though. And it's true, you have a very powerful wind blowing off the disk, but a lot of energy is deposited along the rotational axis, and as I will show, that energy tends to exclude the matter along the rotational axis. To some extent, it's self-cleansing. So the baryonic contamination problem is a problem, but it's not overwhelming. I'll come back to that later. But here the idea is to take a differentially rotating disk. The inner part gets very hot, maybe 30 billion degrees. The binding energy of the disk is emitted as neutrinos, and maybe 1% of that energy is turned into useful electron-positron pair energy. The chief merit of the neutrino annihilation model is that it's calculable. It may be a hard multidimensional calculation, but you can do it on the machine, and several groups have done that. Ruford and Yonka is the work that I'm most familiar with, but there's also been some recent work by, Rosbeg et al., who've reached a very similar conclusion. And I'm not going to dwell on the details of the calculation except to say that they have been done in a post-Newtonian but not general relativistic context. The neutrino transport in the background of a general relativistic gravitational field is rather tough. So the numbers are approximate, but basically one gets on the order of a few hundredths to a few tenths of a solar mass remaining in the disk for the merging neutron star case, and a larger mass for the neutron star plus black hole case. From neutrino annihilation, the energies that you can then get without beaming are in the range 10 to the 49 to 10 to the 51 ergs. So if you could beam this into 10% of the sky, which is not too restrictive, you could still explain a lot of gamma ray bursts. Particularly, let me remind you, we don't have any clue as to the distance of the short hard bursts. We don't know their energy, but we do know that typically they're 1/20th of the total energy of the long complex bursts. They are short. They don't have that greater flux, and so it's much easier energetically to make that class of bursts. As has also been discussed, this is a calculation by Chris Fryer and Dieter Hartmann chiefly. Many calculations of this variety have been done. This is the most recent and one that I'm most familiar with. I think I would describe it as an honest calculation in which all of the parameters that they could think to vary have been varied to test the outcome. And there is some error bar, but I think generically the results are what one expects. And that is for merging neutron stars and neutron star plus black holes, the typical distances that one go depends more on the mass of the galaxy that you're in than anything else. That if you're in an L-star galaxy, you might typically go 10 kiloparsecs or so. But if you're in a galaxy with negligible mass, then you go a much greater distance. What might be more interesting here is the integral of those curves. So for low-mass galaxies and for L-star galaxies in green, this is the distance from the center of the galaxy or from the birth site that the neutron star or the neutron star plus black hole will typically go before the merger occurs and the burst is produced. And you see that you typically are going to go 20 kiloparsecs or so, even in a massive galaxy, and more in a lower mass galaxy for the compact objects, whereas the massive star candidates will die where they're born. The same calculation gives some statistics on how many events you expect per day from these different classes of objects, and I'm not going to have time to go into all of these numbers, but the birth rate, let's see, the red numbers are based on a Madow birth function. The history of star formation is the most critical parameter here. The blue numbers are very optimistic. That assumes that you have star formation that continues all the way back to very early redshifts. If you cut off at redshift 5, you would take about one-fifth of the blue numbers here. And the red ones are for Madow, the unrevised Madow birth function. So typically we have on the order of 1,000 events per day in the galaxy from merging events, and a much larger number, about 10 times larger, of massive star events. And the two numbers for supernova rates in these two models would be 10 to the 7th for the blue numbers. That's 10 to the 7th supernovae per year, it must be. No, I'm sorry. That's per day. Yeah, that's per day. And then 10 to the 5th, or about 1 per second, for the red numbers. And so it turns out that there will be plenty of candidates to make gamma ray bursts by collapsars by a factor of 1,000 or so, so that you can invoke beaming and efficiency factors and get there. But the compact objects are starting to be, they're not ruled out, but they're starting to be in a tight spot with respect to event rate. Because if you can only have between 100 and 1,000 of them in the universe per day, and if you have to beam them to 1% of the sky to get the energy, and if only 10% of them are within star-forming regions and galaxies, then you get an event rate that's on the order of 0.1 to 1 per day. So it's either a success or very tightly constrained, depending on how you look at it. The energy... the star-forming region is because of the oxygen lines that I've heard Jorgowski talk about. Near the galaxy is the observations. Sorry?
Those are from the entire galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
The birth may be anywhere in the galaxy. It may or may not be associated with the star-formation.
But to be within the galaxy, it needs to be within 10 kiloparsecs, wouldn't you say?
That's not the star-formation region, it's the whole galaxy.
But that was this distance. Which
yeah.
we use 10 kiloparsecs
as a cutoff.
Yes.
Yeah. So why do they have to merge within 10 kiloparsecs?
Yeah. To be within galaxies.
Well, I understand the observational data. As soon as they cross 10 kiloparsecs, they said it's a bad time to merge.
No, I'm saying that most of them will typically merge at a distance greater than 10 kiloparsecs from where they were born.
Okay, I don't understand that environmental factor at all. Or do they need high densities to become...
Oh, I'm saying that if you're going to say you have to have them within 10 kiloparsecs and you want to invoke special circumstances, like a dense medium for the jet to run into to make the gamma ray burst, then you have to decrease the total number of events by this factor. Okay?
Yeah.
I'm not ruling it out. I'm not going to rule out any of these models. I'm just saying that it's getting rather constrained, and the energy is also very tightly constrained unless you can invoke the MHD sources. Let me just get to what I want to say about the compact objects, because mostly I want to discuss the massive stars. There are two kinds of solutions that have been discussed, and I don't think people have been clear about the dichotomy in the merging neutron star. You can have the kind of model that Martin especially was discussing on Monday, where the disk lasts a long time, where the disk lasts 10 to 100 seconds, and that requires a very low viscosity disk. In terms of an alpha disk, alpha has to be much less than 10 to the minus 3. And it also requires a very low temperature disk, otherwise you lose 99% of your energy to neutrinos, which are totally neglected in that kind of model. And if you do that, and if you invoke magnetohydrodynamic acceleration of the jet, because neutrinos will give you nothing in that model, then you can get a long energetic burst And I think the attempt has been made to explain the long classical burst that Beppo Sachs has triggered on using the emerging neutron stars. But to do that, you have to follow this path of low entropy, low viscosity, and magnetohydrodynamic acceleration, and I don't think there's any deviation from that line of reasoning. On the other hand, if the disk has some moderate viscosity, say greater than 0.01 for an alpha disk, then it will develop a high temperature and it will emit most of its energy in neutrinos. 99% of the binding energy of the disk will come out in neutrinos. This gives the disk a very short lifetime, on the order of 100 milliseconds or less. And then you can make either a burst with 10% beaming that has an energy inferred to be 10 to the 50 to 52, or a more energetic burst with tighter beaming and magnetohydrodynamical focusing of 10 to the 54 ergs. We have no observations to tell us which one of these routes is correct, but what I do point to is the short time scale here. Yes?
It seems to me that there are two things that lifetime depends on. One is the viscosity, and
yes,
the other one is how far out a significant fraction of the mass reservoir can get. You're saying that is so strongly constrained.
That's been determined pretty well by the multidimensional calculations that watch the neutron stars merge. If they have a viscosity, well, they put no viscosity in those calculations, but their codes, of course, always have viscosity. It corresponds to an alpha of about 10 to the minus 3. And other than the fact that they use this numerical viscosity, everything else, I think, follows naturally. And the time scale they get is on the order of 10, 20 milliseconds. So to conclude this line of discussion, so I can get on with the collapsar discussion, it seems to me, my opinion, and I've said this many times before, but I want to say it clearly today, is that there are at least two classes of bursts. It's harder, in my opinion, to make the short hard bursts than to make the long complex ones. The collapsar, the massive star models, can make the long complex ones, as I'll try to demonstrate. They can never make the short ones. And so why throw away the best candidates for these short bursts that you have by trying to make what Beppo Sachs happened to see, because Hedy didn't go up and see short bursts before Beppo Sachs saw long bursts? I think we're being led down a certain track here by the observations of the year, which will change next year when we know the location of some short hard bursts. And of course, this is a very strong motivation to determining that. But why not have the short hard bursts, which are on the order of a third of the bursts, be short, with low baryon loading, because it's much easier to make a clean jet out of these objects than in a massive star, which is full of baryons. These would not be closely associated with star-forming regions. You might find them in intergalactic space, and they would have a smaller than average redshift because of the delay between their formation. A massive star can make its first gamma ray burst almost immediately, within a few million years. The typical merging neutron star will have a time delay and be at a somewhat lower redshift, maybe 20 or 30% less. So now I want to discuss the other class of models, which is the so-called collapsar. We can talk about terminology. The way I view this is the collapsar is the model, the engine that makes the display that Bodan calls the hypernova. What you have to have in order to begin this is a massive star. It has to be one that has lost its hydrogen envelope. If it doesn't lose its hydrogen envelope first, the jet will do all of its work in that envelope and you'll never see it. And so it has to be the kind of progenitor that would have made a type 1b or c supernova, not the kind that would have made a type 2. It has to be a rotating star and it has to be massive. Now, let me continue to explain why you need those special circumstances before discussing the result. And I should say the numerical work that I'll present here is entirely that of Andrew McFadyen, who's here and also has a poster paper on some of this. I think I'll skip this. We've already had some discussion about the rotation of stars when they die. This is very difficult to know. You don't know very well what to start with, although it seems quite reasonable to start with a star that is rotating rigidly on the main sequence with an observed equatorial velocity of 220 kilometers per second. And then if you include all of the, admittedly with multiplying parameters on all of them, but put in Eddington sweet circulation, dynamical and secular shear, Goldreich, Schubert, Fricke instability, all of the ways we know of transporting angular momentum in stars, except for magnetic fields, leave that out, If we evolve this star all the way to the point where it is a pre-supernova, this is the distribution of angular momentum that Alex Hager gets. And in more recent calculations, this red curve, which is the pre-supernova, is raised by about 50%. That has to do with how you treat composition barriers in the evolution of the star. That gives you an angular momentum out at 3 solar masses or so that is almost 10 to the 17th erg seconds. That is what you need for the collapsar model. And this is a single star, no binary involved. Now, if you did end up with less angular momentum, if you ended up with less than 3 times 10 to the 16, when you form the black hole, the star will fall in, nothing will happen, this model does not work, and I can work on something else. So it has to rotate rapidly for this to work. That's the biggest Achilles heel. If you can punch a hole in that, then you can kill the model. And I'll admit right up front that the Crab pulsar is actually down here somewhere. So this is a lot of rotation compared to what you see in typical pulsars. Maybe pulsars are born rotating faster and slow down by gravitational radiation. But this is only 1% or less of the massive star deaths that I'm talking about here. It could be a special case. You could also get 10 to the 17th erg seconds, which is the necessary angular momentum, from the evolution of a binary system. If you merged 2 helium cores, a rigidly rotating helium core after a merger with 10% of the breakup rotation would have J of 10 to the 17. Yes, Bodin.
And, just a point which Ralph brought up
an
hour ago, but in reverse, white dwarfs, which are rotating at several day periods, clearly have not conserved angular momentum from the main. So here is a case where we see rotation which may be fast compared to what you would have if you had complete coupling between the core and the envelope.
Yes.
But certainly far too slow for conserving angular momentum.
It may well be that Spruett and Finney are right and that you can't have this rapidly rotating helium core live for 1 million years inside the red giant envelope. In the population synthesis that Chris Fryer did, 99% of the progenitors of the collapsar were binaries in which the envelope was removed by the binary companion, and so it doesn't have the long time to slow down, and that may be quite important. 10% of them were helium core mergers. But we are invoking special circumstances, but it's a rare event. The second thing that must happen is that the supernova explosion mechanism has to fail. Now, Bodin said we don't understand how supernovae blow up very well. I have watched it almost as long as he has, and we understand it a whole lot better than we used to. There are quite a few people who would say the problem is solved. I don't think it's solved because it hasn't been done in 3 dimensions with good neutrino physics yet. But we do routinely, Chris Fryer and Adam Burrows and Thomas Janka, 3 groups do routinely get energetic supernova explosions running realistic physics in a multidimensional hydrocode. But what Chris has found, Chris Fryer, is that the explosion is much easier to develop in a lower mass star than in a higher mass. In a 25 solar mass star, the focus could be better here, couldn't it? A little better?
Yeah.
In a 25 solar mass star, 140 milliseconds after bounce, you're still trying to overcome the ram pressure of infalling material while the 15 solar mass star is already blown up. Eventually, the 25 blows up, but it takes a much longer time for the explosion to develop. And the reason for this is that the accretion rate is very much higher onto the compact, collapsed iron core, protoneutron star, whatever you want to call it. It's an order of magnitude higher in a 40 solar mass supernova progenitor than in a 15 solar mass progenitor. It is hard to make those blow up. When you put the explosion energy that he calculates for 3 stars, you see a trend of explosion energy going down, while the binding energy of the mantle that the supernova must explode in order to be a supernova is rising. The bigger stars have more binding energy. And so there comes a point at about 22 or 23 solar masses where not all of the material outside the core can achieve escape velocity, and some of it falls back and makes a black hole at late time. These are not collapsar progenitors. The fallback is too slow. But about 40 solar masses, we believe that the mechanism will fail entirely, and you'll produce a black hole, and the star will fall into it. If the star has the angular momentum that I just invoked, then something like what I'm going to describe must happen.
How much of this
When? In which case? In this intermediate case, you can make... In the last one, you make a black hole promptly. The whole star tries to fall in. I'll come to that in a minute, because the falling in produces a supernova of its own variety. And so only a couple of solar masses, we think, fall in. Two or three. But what happens now is that you've produced a black hole in a rotating massive star. And so the star tries to fall in, and if there were no rotation, this would be uninteresting. Everything would fall in hypersonically, and nuclear burning wouldn't reverse it, and the star would simply disappear. But these are the density contours 7 seconds after the formation of a black hole in a 14 solar mass helium core, and you see the development of a rotationally supported torus with densities going up to about 100 billion grams per cubic centimeter at 50 kilometers. That density distribution depends on the viscosity you use. At lower viscosity, sorry, at higher viscosities, this was alpha of 10 to the minus 4. 10 to the minus 1 gives you this density distribution 100 times lower. For the higher viscosities, these disks are neutrino dominated. For the lower viscosities, they are not. So the neutrino powered jet requires high disk viscosity, 0.1. roughly in terms of alpha. There are analytic solutions to the inner disk for accreting rotating black holes that Bob Popham has calculated, and the multidimensional calculation of McFadyen is shown as the X's, and the blue lines are the analytic solutions, and they show that in the region where a disk has formed, here's a shock wave outside the disk, Andrew's solutions agree very well with the analytic solutions, which confirms both calculations, but also means that we can extrapolate the temperature and density into the event horizon using Popham's model in order to calculate the neutrino emission and the efficiency of nu nu bar. Something worth mentioning in terms of internal shocks making the gamma ray burst, we find that this accretion disk has instabilities, that the accretion is not steady, that it turns on and off very rapidly. The reason for that appears to be a photodisintegration instability in the disk, but you get very rapid time variability that has been time resolved in the calculation. Here is one spike resolved with 17,500 models, and so it really is, we think, not just numerical noise, but something that's going on in the disk itself. If we do a power spectrum of those instabilities, we find typically 50 milliseconds and the first overtone at 25 milliseconds in the accretion rate. This ultimately probably gives rise to a variation in the gamma of the outgoing jet. It certainly does in the neutrino model. Bodan, partly in response to your question about the disk and its wind, because viscosity is powering the neutrino emission, the energy deposition from viscosity is much more than the neutrinos themselves can do, especially when the disk is thin to neutrinos. And so, yes, indeed, there is a lot of energy deposition going on just above the disk. This is entropy, color-coded, and what we see is that there is a strong wind being blown off the disk, and it is going off at an angle like this. Now, at this present time, the accretion is still continuing, and the jet hasn't started yet. But there will indeed be very powerful winds blown from the disk by whatever is making your viscosity, magnetic fields, and we see these plumes eventually extending all the way to the surface, and it's a very violent wind. This is a supernova all by itself. This is 10 to the 51 ergs, just in the viscosity-powered wind. But we also want to put a jet into this situation in a minute, and I'll tell you why. First, a comment on the Kerr parameter. These are extreme Kerr holes. They form rotating rapidly, and they continue to accrete from Keplerian orbit, and so they grow up to a Kerr value that might be as great as 0.95, but certainly is as great as 0.8. And so there's a lot of rotational energy to extract here. It also means that the inner orbit is much closer to the center of the black hole, and you can get more gravitational potential energy out of it. Now, this is the neutrino emission of the disk, and because the disk accretion rate is varying rapidly with time, so too is the neutrino luminosity. Those neutrinos are running into one another along the rotational axis, and you can calculate And this is one place where we need a lot more numerical work to get it accurately. There's an order of magnitude uncertainty in the neutrino transport calculation here. But you can calculate how much energy is being deposited by neutrino annihilation along the axis. And it's somewhere between a few times 10 to the 51 to 10 to the 52 ergs. This is the neutrino, integrated neutrino energy, somewhere between 1 and 3 times 10 to the 53 ergs. So almost the same energy in neutrinos comes out here as when you make a type 2 supernova. The difference is energy that is advected into the hole and not emitted. But even with 2% efficiency, you can convert, and that's calculated, not just estimated, you can convert the neutrino emission into pair energy along the rotational axis. Now, about the baryon loading. First, let me emphasize that while I'm talking about neutrinos here, anything that could work for merging neutron stars in the way of magnetohydrodynamic jets would work just as well here. It's the same kind of object, the same accretion rates, so what works there works here. We're talking about neutrinos chiefly because we can do the calculation without making too many ad hoc assumptions. There's still a few, but not so many. Now, one reason the neutrino power jet tends to cleanse itself of baryons is that the energy deposition, these are contours of energy deposition, ergs per cubic centimeter per second, they have a curve like this and not a curve like that. That means the pressure gradient is directed outwards from the axis, and so the expansion of the bubble that you blow with these neutrinos tends to cleanse the jet of baryons. And so it rises up. There's also centrifugal forces that tend to keep the wind from the disk coming in here. And there is another effect that Chris Fryer pointed out that may be quite important. When a neutrino comes from one side of the disk and meets its counterpart coming from the other side of the disk, only one of these is an anti-neutrino, then it makes an electron-positron pair, but each neutrino had momentum along the rotational axis.
But counteracting it, don't you get a neutrino version of radiation viscosity that would tend to entrain some material from the wall to the front?
That's what Bodan was alluding to. And you will get some, but the efficiency here is low. I mean, there is much more material blowing off the disk due to viscosity than there is matter in this column. But the column tends to exclude that. There will be an unknown amount of entrainment, and we go ahead and do the calculation, but we don't have the resolution to see that entrainment. In our calculation, it's very small. So the momentum of the pairs and of the bubble of radiation will already be directed along the rotational axis. If we take that energy deposition, which is somewhere between 3 and 12 times 10 to the 51 ergs, and deposit it above the axis, on the axis of rotation above and below the black hole, then we get jets. This is just from hydrodynamical focusing. It's just the result of depositing 10 to the 51 ergs per second in a very small region here about 100 kilometers above the black hole. The calculation couldn't go right down to the black hole because of current time limitations, but putting in the energy there, you get this development, and the jets stay very well collimated. Now, if you started out with an MHD collimated jet, it would stay at least this narrow, but just hydrodynamical focusing keeps the jet within about a 10-degree opening angle when it finally breaks through the surface of the star. With the people in Munich, we've started to do these calculations in a special relativistic code. Andrew's code is Newtonian, and that's one reason we can't watch it go up to gamma of 10 cubed. We have watched it go up to gamma of 10 cubed, but what we really saw was the velocity went up to 10 to the 12 centimeters per second. And we didn't think you'd like that very much, and so we've kept the energies purposefully low. Now, two possibilities here that depend on how long this jet is maintained. The duration of the jet is being set by how long and how fast the star is accreting. We see that after about 10 seconds, that accretion subsides. Now, there's an interesting congruence in time scale in that the duration, at least of a neutrino powered jet, I don't know how long the MHD powered jet would last, but for the neutrino powered jet, it lasts about as long as it takes to break through the surface of the star. It takes about 10 seconds to drill. I mean, you've made this gamma ray burst at the middle of the sun, essentially. And, you know, originally I thought that's just desperate. It'll never get out. But we've got a relativistic drill here with more energy than anything you ever dreamed of 2 years ago anyway. And it's drilling through the star, but it takes a while. It takes 10 seconds to drill a hole in a star with a relativistic jet of this energy and momentum. Now suppose the jet turned off before it got out of the star. I'm not going to call this a failed gamma ray burst. I've already been down that path. I'll call it a smothered gamma ray burst, one that has too much baryon loading to ever develop really relativistic outflow. That's one possibility. But another possibility is that it stays on for longer than 10 seconds, drills its hole, breaks out through the surface, and eventually reaches the full value that's given by the energy density at its base in the hot models, or by the gamma of the MHD engine if it's a magnetohydrodynamic jet. The beaming we calculate to be about 1% of the sky, and the energy 10 to the 50 to 52 ergs without beaming, just from neutrinos. And with beaming, you can raise this to 10 to the 54, but probably not more. Now, I just wanted to show some pictures since I'm running out of time. This is Andrew McFadyen's poster paper, and you can look at it. But this is a jet that was turned on and run for 5 seconds and then turned off. So this is a smothered gamma ray burst. And so 3 seconds later, this is velocity, and a typical velocity here is 50,000 kilometers per second in this material.
How much energy?
A total, so you put in 10 to the 51 ergs per second for 5 seconds, is that right? 5 times 10 to the 51 ergs. And then this matter erupts through the surface. Now, as the jet moves out, a shock wave is moving around the star. And so we have a supernova. It's a different kind of supernova. It's an axially driven supernova, one that's driven by a relativistic jet going up its axis, not by a spherical neutrino bubble, but by the passage of the jet. This shock wraps around the whole star after 30 seconds and blows it away with velocities on the order of 10,000 kilometers per second, more at the surface, and leaves 2 or 3 solar masses behind that can still continue the accretion for a while. Sorry? That depends on how long you leave the jet on. In this case, all of it was non-relativistic or very mildly relativistic. If you left the jet on for a lot longer, then most of it would come out in the relativistic jet. But typically 10 to the 51, maybe 52 ergs in the total of the two. So, since time is running out, let me just say what I'm getting at here. I think the suffocated, smothered gamma ray burst was 98 BW, and you can, for a given explosion energy, you can calculate using some scaling laws that may not be very accurate, 1985, but it's basically along the ideas of Stirling-Colgate. Hello, Stirling. That wake up, Stirling. That this mildly relativistic material goes down the density gradient. And Roger, I heard what you said, but this is because it's focused into a small fraction of the area. The energy here could be the equivalent of a 2 × 10³ erg explosion if it had been spherical. That's if you deposited not 10⁵, but about 10⁵ ergs per second. Maybe it takes an MHD jet, but a tiny bit of material, 5 × 10²⁷ grams, accelerated to a gamma of 4, might make the gamma ray burst within about a tenth of an AU, running into the circumstellar mass loss of the pre-explosive star. In the other case, which may be less common, where the jet stays on for a long time and reaches its asymptotic value, when you're looking straight down the jet, then you can see a classical gamma ray burst. So this is an attempt, maybe a little strained, but it's reasonable to try to relate 98 BW and classical gamma ray bursts. They may not be so diverse as you think, in that the engine may be very similar in the two, and they just differed in the baryon loading, how long the jet was on, and how much energy it contained, which in turn could reflect the mass of the star and its angular momentum distribution when it blew up. So some predictions of the Collapsar model. These are the same predictions I had in Rome, but I've typed them in pretty color. If it is a collapsar that is making all of the long gamma ray bursts, then they should be associated with star formation regions. So maybe this is more a prediction than an observation, but they certainly should be in galaxies, and they should be right in the same H2 regions and molecular clouds where they were born. You need to have a helium core of at least 10 solar masses, an angular momentum between 0.5 and 2 times 10 to the 17th erg seconds, no hydrogen envelope on the star. There may be some evolution because low metallicity will favor these objects. Low metallicity keeps the wind losses down, makes the star bigger when it dies. Wind carries away angular momentum also. So it may be that looking back in time, these are actually a larger fraction of supernovae than they are at the present time. Every gamma ray burst makes a supernova. Now, this is something I've been trying to ram home for 2 years now. Not every supernova makes a gamma ray burst. Less than 1% of the type 1bc supernovae make gamma ray bursts. Most of them make neutron stars and ordinary supernovae that we understand well. But in about one event in 100, you make a gamma ray burst. But every gamma ray burst produced by a collapsar, every jet tunneling through a star of this sort blows up the star and makes a supernova. And so it goes that way, but not the other way. And it could be that besides 98 BW and April 25th, that the February 36th event... What's the right phone number there?
326.
Yeah. See the poster by Bloom, and Kulkarni discussed it yesterday. This might be an example of such an event. These supernovae, by the way, though, are not hydrodynamic. They're entirely powered by the radioactive decay of cobalt-56. And so their brightness is strictly a function of how much cobalt you make. And you won't get to magnitude minus 20. It's going to be more like minus 19, 19 and a half. In fact, 98 BW had a very similar light curve to a type 1A supernova. The maximum was almost identical. The duration of the gamma ray burst has a natural time scale in that it's related to the collapse time of the pre-supernova star, and then the time it takes a shock wave to wrap around that star once you've made the jet. And those two time scales are both about 20 seconds. The time structure, the internal shocks may result from internal shocks and disk instabilities. I've been given the sign to hurry up here. Beaming of 1%, diverse energy. 98 BW and April 25th were the same event. Willing to make bets, pay off, drink wine, whatever. I strongly believe this. The event rate of the collapsars, if we had a star formation rate like Madow calculated at Z of 1.5 extending out to Z of 5, could be 10 to the 4th per day of collapsars. So with beaming of 1%, that's 100 events per day. So there still could be a lot of them that we haven't seen yet. The 98 BW events could be the most common ones in the universe, and they may be a lot more of them than there are. They may be the most common events in the universe. The short hard bursts come from merging neutron stars and black holes. The large rotation rate implies that you have millisecond pulsars occasionally at birth, perhaps slowed by gravitational radiation. You do get X-ray precursors in this model because as the shock wave erupts through the surface and runs into the circumstellar material, it can make a weak display, somewhat like April 25th, 98, and the photons move faster than any jet, so they run ahead of the relativistic jet that follows that makes the major gamma ray burst, and the nucleosynthesis may be very interesting in these objects. Thank you.
Two questions. One is, there is no evidence, to my knowledge, of millisecond pulsars being born, or neutron stars being born at millisecond rotating orbit.
Yes,
if it was born at a millisecond, you're looking at a high omega square.
I believe there are some, this bothers me too, but I believe there are some papers, is it by Lindler or Lindblom, anyway, that gravitational radiation during the first few years could slow a millisecond pulsar down.
Yeah, but that's fine. So let's get them born at 100 microseconds, I have no problems. But
you can't see them the first year or two anyway.
I have no problems with that too.
Okay.
So let the gravitational bit slow down and at 0.6, 0.7 milliseconds, whichever is the equation of state.
No, he's had them slowing down a lot more than that.
Oh, no. What I'm saying is then it switches to the electromagnetic channel, right? And that it dumps. So the 10 to the 52 Hz is when it switches on to the electromagnetic channel.
Depending on its magnetic field.
Okay, so if it has no magnetic field, then it will be seen as a millisecond pulsar much later, because it's going to just coast along. So the easiest one is to simply go and do a volumetric calculation of supernovae, remnant, and there's absolutely no indication other than our galaxy or in nearby things, because this will be amazing supernovae actually, because you're releasing 10 of it.
Yeah, I know. This was discussed in 87A a lot, and there's really no evidence for this huge, brilliant burst early on. It would depend on how much you could slow it down by gravitational radiation before the pulsar became the dominant mechanism.
You need to deform this guy.
This was not a major, this was small deformations. I should have a better reference for you for that. But it could be a problem. You had 2 points, though, just a second.
Yeah, another one is, the thing that still amazes me about gamma ray bursts is, why is this, in some ways we are talking about a phenomenon which is very diverse. In some ways, maybe not in your picture, but in some ways. Yet, why is it that this phenomenon loves to express itself in the 100 keV to 1 MeV range? So is this some mechanism which loves that particular energy band, or is it that, for example, in your picture, you said the smothered objects. Oh, so I can think of this completely smothered, in which case we'll see eventually in the optical. Then I can think which are bore, you know, a very nice tunnel, in which case they are at MeV. But I could see stuff at 30 kV, 10 kV, few kV. And to my knowledge, and I really do wish some of the high energy types would actually comment this, battery has very good sensitivity down to about 40 kV. Yet there's a sharp cutoff at the low energy end, and that bothers me a bit.
I don't know. I do know that at least one burst had a very large GeV component to it. It might have even dominated the energy budget. This number seems to come up frequently, though. 93J, which was not a gamma ray burst, emitted 100 kilovolt radiation for several months after the event. It's not something I understand.
Martin?
There's two comments there. First, although you didn't include magnetic fields, I'm sure you would agree, and even know that would, that if one were to include magnetic fields, it would very much ease the task.
Absolutely.
Residue suggests in these models.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I'd also to say that I certainly like your distinction that the short bursts are more naturally explained by binding neutron star mergers. With the difference is that in your model, you still have the same central engine with a neutron density torus around the black hole, but a bit of neutron star debris does not have to stay in residence for the whole duration.
That's right. The accretion rate is being given by the star and not by the viscous time scale here. But I would flip the coin over and say, I can't make short bursts with this model, and so I need to.
But the other point I want to make is that in the long bursts, with complex time structure, if one explains those internal shocks, you need to have some variability in the jets with a time scale of a few seconds.
That's right.
And that again, I think, is easier to understand in your model, because you would say that some instability not down at the base but in the walls of the jet further out. So I think it's easier in your model also to get the very large substructure with a time scale of seconds rather than milliseconds.
Yes, thank you, I agree. The 50 millisecond pulses, the internal shocks for those are all inside the gamma ray photosphere, and we won't see those. It's only the 1 second variation and longer that would exist outside the photosphere.
Yeah.
I can't hear you very well because of the motor.
The pop synthesis that you guys are doing, are you getting, it looks like you're getting 5 times as many black hole neutrons that are binary as you are.
I believe that's correct. Chris Fryer did the calculation and can address that.
I'm assuming that if the neutron star,
That would be right.
But I think most of the calculations regarding offsets that have been done with the neutron star mergers showed much sort of closer relationship to the host galaxy. So I guess the question is,
you could expect that black hole because their binaries are sort of less thick on average.
It's not that different, as I understand. It's the second kick that matters. Chris, you want to comment?
It's not for these beta Brown mechanisms, you're forming a very low mass black hole, and you get the same double kick. They form a neutron star that then accretes a little bit of mass to form a black hole, but it's a low mass black hole, and you get the second kick as well. So you're essentially getting the same, it's slightly lower, but not a factor of 10 lower.
Okay, I guess the point is, though, that other models where you just use neutron star neutron star binaries, you get a better relationship to the galaxy, so you don't need them. You
know,
you don't need more than half to go farther.
One more question.
Michael. If 98 BW is a classical system, by the way, would you expect to see the radio afterglow when it becomes standard?
That's really two questions. Another possibility, aside from a smothered jet, is that you had the jet go ahead and break out and you saw the mildly relativistic material off axis. And I don't know how to distinguish those two right now. You're saying if that was the case with the afterglow?
Yeah, you would get 1 millimeter, fraction of a millimeter.
I don't think you can distinguish. By the time you're to the optical and radio afterglow, a very much larger amount of material that has a much larger angle is producing the afterglow, you know, maybe out to 30 or 40 degrees. So I don't think the afterglow by itself enables you to distinguish these two possibilities. Was that your question?
No.
Okay.
That was my question.
I'm sorry, I still didn't understand.
Well, the classical burst is at 5 gigabytes.
He's saying it must be a failed burst, not a burst inside. Otherwise, you'd see a strong radio source.
Yeah. But you take 0.08. When it becomes natural, it's inside the probe. And it is a fraction of a
millichamp
at 5.
Oh, 0508.
To scale that to 50 megabytes, it makes more than one chance.
Okay. I think the chairman would like for us to continue this.
Yes, everybody obviously needs some coffee so you can come over a lot. We'll reconvene at 10 after 11.
You didn't say it, but. You didn't say it, Mike.